couple megs are probably gonna take a couple seconds. There we go. Okay, what I'm gonna do is largely kind of amplify on what Dr. Mellon talked about. I'm gonna focus on the U.S. because that's where we have the most experience with genetically engineered crops, and I'm going to talk about a couple major points. One is what have genetically engineered crops contributed to yield, and what have they contributed to pesticide use or reduction. But I want to start with talking about the challenge a little bit, because we've been hearing about the food crisis globally. I think it's important to start with understanding that right now that crisis is really a matter of distribution and cost and distortions of market, rather than an inherent lack of ability to feed the entire global population. But we do have a growing population. It's expected to be up to 50% higher by the mid-century, and that will continue to put additional pressure on land use for growing our crops. In addition, a growing middle class in populous developing countries is leading to increased consumption of animal products, and animal products have an inherent inefficiency in their production, in this case represented by about 7 pounds, for example, of corn to produce about a pound of beef. So obviously it takes a lot more crop land when we're using crops to feed our animals, as we do largely in the U.S., to produce our food than if we just consume the crops themselves. And then, of course, the downside to industrial agriculture is that it has many negative externalities, both for public health, society, and, of course, the environment. And I've listed a few here just to highlight a couple of those. As some people aren't aware, that it's a very important source of climate change emissions. Some estimates consider up to about 37% of all climate change emissions. Animal agriculture produces, depending on the data, anywhere from 17-18% of climate change emissions, more than probably the transportation sector. We use about 70% of all fresh water goes to production of our food. So it's a huge impact on the environment. So starting, I want to talk about yield, and as Dr. Mellon mentioned, we can split this for our discussion purposes into two types of yield: potential yield or intrinsic yield, how a crop can yield under ideal conditions, and then operational yield, or yield in the real world under pressure from stress and pests. And I just want to emphasize that this is data from the Department of Agriculture. As you can see, increasing yield in crops has occurred for many years, and this could be taken back to the 20s or 30s, but as Dr. Mellon said, about a 1% or 2% increase per yield in the case of corn per year. So what has genetic engineering accomplished? As Dr. Mellon said, there are no traits currently on the market that improve intrinsic yield. But there are things on the traits on the drawing board, and I'll get into that in a bit. I want to start out by putting a few numbers behind what we've started talking about in terms of operational yield for the major crops that are out there in the U.S. right now, the major genetically engineered crops. The biggest one in terms of acreage is herbicide-tolerant soybeans. This allows us to spray herbicides right onto the crop so that we're not killing the crop and treating the weeds that way. But a number of studies have shown that, in fact, we don't have any increased operational yield in these crops. There's a few studies that suggest some small increases, and many that suggest decreases, but I think a generous summary would be that there's no real increase in yields in these crops. I just want to show this yield trend graph just to emphasize one point. The variation that you see from year to year, which is pretty large, really is a representation in part of impacts on operational yield, drought, flooding, pests, et cetera. And as you can see, you know, there's a lot of variation from year to year, and since genetic engineering was introduced around here in the mid-90s, we're still getting, you know, a lot of variation from year to year. And that's because, again, as Dr. Mellon mentioned, There are many traits, many conditions in the environment that that impact operational yield. Many pests, I'm a plant pathologist by training, there are many diseases that impact yield, many insects, weeds, drought, salinity, and we only have basically two types of crops that address only a very few of those traits. Well, what about the insect-resistant crops that Dr. Mellon mentioned? Corn is the main food crop or feed crop, and again, these are BT crops. The first one that came out in the mid-90s was to control an important insect called corn borer. How has that impacted yield? Well, first we have to consider that significant yield losses, economic yield losses, only occurred on roughly 5 to 15, maybe sometimes stretching at 20% of corn acres per year. That were moderately to heavily infested with corn borer. That upper end would probably be a stretch. The yield advantage of BT on those acres could be substantial, up to 20%, maybe sometimes more. But we did have, although not entirely desirable, alternatives to BT in the form of insecticides. And when compared, BT compared to insecticide, you get a much smaller range of yield benefits depending on the studies. And when you take the fact that the significant yield losses were only on 15, let's say 20% of the corn acres, to be generous, for a 1 to 7% yield, we come out overall with roughly probably about a 1% yield gain in these 13 years since this has been commercialized. And again, that's in contrast with the yield gains that we get through other methods of about 1% per year. So you can compare that over the last 13 years. The other major trait that's been engineered into corn is another type of BT gene to control another major insect pest called rootworm. This is an average yield increase over pesticide from one of the scientists and entomologists, Marlon Rice, that works on this. He estimated it would be about 1.5% to 4% or an average of about 3% improvement over insecticide. But again, not all corn acres needed to be treated because we can often control rootworms simply by good agriculture practices like rotating crops, alternating instead of growing corn all the time, you know, alternating it with different crops. That's failed in some areas, and in some areas there, in 2000, this is USDA data, they said they treated 18% of corn acres with insecticide for rootworm. It's probably somewhat higher now due to genetic changes in the insect. But again, if we look at the 3% yield improvement for 18% of corn acres, for all corn acres, that only comes to about 0.6% roughly, or somewhere below 1%. And if we look at the advantage from both of the major pests over this past 13 years, it only comes to a couple percent. So again, not nearly comparable to what we're getting just from conventional practices. And I think we also have to remember, as Dr. Mellon mentioned, that we have non-insecticide alternatives to BT. Conventional breeding is making advances on corn borer, for example, using tropical corn cultivars to get genetic material through conventional breeding. Organic production has been shown to greatly reduce corn borer infestation. And as I said, crop rotation can greatly reduce rootworm. So, and I think Dr. Booty will talk more about this afterwards, but to some extent, maybe not the specifics, but the basic point being that we can often get comparable yields with other methods that are much better for the environment. Well, what about looking ahead? What about the prospects for improving potential yield potential? We can look at the USDA's data on this, and this is extracted from the data on experimental field trials. So this is probably, at best, 5 years before commercialization. So out of a total of 848 field trials over the last year, only 9% have now been targeted towards improved yield. And as you can see, many are still focused mainly on herbicide and insect resistance, mainly the traits they're already working on, and then a bunch for other types of traits. Of that 9% yield increase, the vast majority is for corn, a feed crop rather than an important food crop for most of the world, and soybeans, only 7% for rice, 1% for wheat, and 7% for other, none for all these important crops for developing countries like cassava, sorghum, millet, etc. So that whatever emphasis there is right now is really not at all on a lot of important food crops. A big challenge will be the complexity of these traits. The first generation of traits like BT were single genes that acted directly, so it produced a toxin, and the toxin directly killed the insects. But yield traits are going to be much more complex. So this is an example of one type called a transcription factor, where you get a gene, a single gene, but that gene produces something that affects the expression of all these other genes. And then these genes, in turn, can affect the production of other genes. So you get a complex network of production. What that means is you may be targeting one gene here for yield increase, but all these others are affecting something else in the crop. And often those can be either negative in terms of risk issues or other agronomic properties. Making a crop that has higher yield but also is fine in terms of everything else can be a major challenge. So I want to just go quickly into two examples. Apetala 2 is one that the industry is looking at. That's one of these transcription factors. And ERA1 for drought resistance, which has been in the news recently. It was mentioned in an article in the New York Times just last week. So Apetala 2 mutants, this particular gene, have been found to produce higher seeds and thereby larger yields in mild mustard. But unfortunately, this gene also affects other aspects in the crop, in this case, flower development. So this is what a flower, wild-type flower in wild mustard looks like. This is the mutant flower in an Apetala 2 mutant. Now, there's some genetic tricks you can use to try to get around this, but they won't necessarily get at all of the potential unintended effects on the crop that you see here. The other gene is ERA1 for drought tolerance, and so what's been found and reported in the media is that this can improve drought tolerance by roughly 15% without losing yield when the crops have adequate water, which is an important consideration. But a very recent work by another lab has found that this gene also controls the ability of a crop to defend itself against a number of disease organisms. And so there's the possibility that if this was commercialized, that plants could become more susceptible to these classes of disease organisms, and therefore it may improve intrinsic yield in some ways, but make the crop, but result in higher use of pesticides. Another route is improving the ability of plants to capture light. For example, one thing that's been done through conventional breeding is just improving the architecture of leaves so that they capture more sunlight. Another route is improving several of the enzymes in the photosynthetic pathway, but again, these have the potential, as with the other genes, of having other unintended consequences, and we don't really know whether they'll work. So this is much more challenging than what's been done in genetic engineering before. But there are some promising developments on the horizon. This is drought-tolerant pearl millet. Here's the drought-tolerant variety. Here's drought-susceptible variety. But this wasn't done with genetic engineering. This is done with advanced conventional breeding, in this case something called marker-assisted selection. So again, I just want to emphasize that there are many other technologies that are out there that are showing a lot of potential that don't have some of the downsides of genetic engineering. Finally, what about pesticide use? What about these externalities that industrial agriculture causes? So let's look at the two crops that we've been discussing in terms of pesticide use. A problem that's arising with herbicide-tolerant crops is that they're leading to resistant weeds, weeds that are resistant to the herbicide. The first one that was discovered was horseweed in 2000. This crop can produce hundreds of thousands of seeds in individual plant and spread very rapidly, and now infests at least several million acres in the Midwest and Upper South. Since then, we now have about seven different crops that are resistant to the main herbicide glyphosate in a number of different states, and some of these are of major concern. One of them that's of great concern is pigweed or amaranth, Palmer amaranth in this case, is an agronomist from the University of Georgia in a pigweed-infested cotton field. Or actually, this is really, I think, a pigweed field infested with cotton. There's a cotton plant down there, and there's one down here, but this is mostly pigweed. And this is a really major concern and is really scaring many of the agronomists in the country. There's this weed, but others as well. What about herbicide use? So this is figures that Dr. Benbrook has kindly allowed us to use that he's developed recently. But the result of this increasing herbicide resistance and other factors is increasing herbicide use on these genetically engineered herbicide-tolerant crops. So in 1996, for example, we actually used less herbicide on herbicide-tolerant genetically engineered soybean than conventional. But over time, this has changed so that now we're using more herbicide on the genetically engineered soybean than on the conventional soybean, and the cumulative increase over the years has been about 26%. What about BT crops? Herbicides have looked pretty good, insecticides too. The herbicide use, Dr. Benbrook's projecting, is changing, and you can see that the advantage, the reduction in herbicide use is declining over time. There has been, and I guess one of the success stories for genetically engineered crops is there has been a reduction in chemical insecticide use, which is a good thing. If we add all that together, we get a reduction in pesticide use on corn of about 2.7%, and when comparing all of the crops, including cotton in this case, from 96 to 98, there's a growth of about 6.5%. Of pesticide use overall. So when we're considering pesticide use of the technology as a whole, it looks like it's increased pesticide use rather than decreasing it. Another concern is overuse of genetically engineered traits. So BT is actually planted on considerably more acres than were previously treated with insecticide. And this is from a recent paper by Marvier et al., where they looked at impacts on biodiversity of BT crops. If you look at this particular column here, what it shows is a comparison of biodiversity from, this is a meta-analysis, so combining dozens of different studies that have been done and published. This shows the impact of comparing BT crops BT corn with corn that's not treated with any insecticide, and the fact that it's below the zero line indicates that there's a decrease in biodiversity in those crops, fairly small, but a significant decrease when you use BT crops. So on all those acres, those several tens of millions of acres where BT is being used, where no insecticide was used before, you're probably getting a decrease in biodiversity. Another problem is that the companies are stacking these traits. They're putting in the same crop herbicide tolerant, several insect resistance genes, and they're eliminating their single GE trait crops, so that farmers are being forced to buy crops with several of these genes in it when they don't necessarily need them all. So whatever impacts they're having will be thereby amplified. So in conclusion, genetic engineering has really only marginally increased operational yields after 13 years of commercialization. Even these first so-called first-generation crops, which were everybody acknowledges easier to do, have had minimal impacts. The success of new GE yield traits is going to be significantly more challenging. Again, as Dr. Mellon said, it's not to say that there won't be any breakthroughs, but it's questionable as to how much, and it's certainly not a guarantee. There's been very little impact on genetic engineering of decreasing the negative impacts of industrial agriculture. And as Dr. Mellon said, there's ecologically sound alternatives to genetic engineering that are not getting nearly enough attention. And really, we need to start looking at those more and giving them the attention they deserve. Thank you.